Even though this job takes us to so many places, we seem to go to the same 10 to 15 countries 90% of the time. So when the opportunity arises to go to a city outside of the norm, Bob and I usually jump the line and pick it up.
Off we go to Tokyo.
Not wearing my mask.
Me either. I'm not wearing it. We're going to Tokyo. Get a 14-hour flight ahead.
So we can stay there for less than 24 hours and get on another airplane and get back.
Yeah, exactly.
In early 22, masks were still required on airplanes, and much of Asia was still mostly locked down.
Hello. How are you? Hey.
But Japan had a crew loophole called a shore pass, and a pair of recently retired JAL 767s needed to be moved to the United States for part out. Bob and I met up in Dallas to catch the nonstop on American to Narita out of DFW. There weren't many people back to traveling internationally yet, so we had a mostly empty airplane to ourselves. After 2 years of it, this had become the norm, and I was getting used to it. Now in 2024, looking back, it seems surreal.
Are we in Zagreb?
I don't think I could say Tokyo, right?
I don't know. How do they say it in Kentucky? China.
I don't think I want to put anything racist on this.
Probably not a good idea. Now I'm going to have to bleep stuff.
Mere hours before, it was snowing as I drove over the Walt Whitman Bridge into South Philly heading to the airport. But now as we crossed the similar-looking Rainbow Bridge in Tokyo under clear skies, I remembered how much I really love the vibrant city of Tokyo. Unfortunately, though, we wouldn't be able to venture away from the hotel due to the COVID restrictions in place. Still, I picked a hotel that would give us the vibe of the city and also one with great food options.
Wow, what a view. What a view.
We chose the Hyatt over by the Haneda Airport, where we were scheduled to depart the next afternoon. Haneda's right downtown, unlike the Narita Airport, which is actually pretty far from Tokyo by car. The Hyatt Regency Tokyo Bay has a really good teppanyaki place right on the lobby level. And after we checked in, we poked our head in and the chef showed us some unbelievable looking Wagyu beef. So the question of what's for dinner was an extremely easy one.
Go ahead.
In the last few years, I've only been to Tokyo for aircraft leasing conferences and in transit to or from somewhere else. For whatever reason, trips into and out of Japan are really rare. Back in 2012, we moved a half dozen MD-90s out of JAL to Delta Airlines, and 10 years later, this was actually our first time back flying airplanes out. Dinner was amazing, and we actually headed to our rooms before sundown to get a full night's rest for a change before the long Pacific crossing the next day.
All right, we're downstairs here in Tokyo having some breakfast. I got up at 4:30 a.m. Bob, what about you?
I woke up at 1 a.m., couldn't go back to sleep. Now I ate this big breakfast and I'm ready to go to sleep.
Good thing you have a few hours. We don't have to report for like another 3 or 4 hours.
A couple hours. What time do we take off? Like 2 o'clock today?
3:05 is our departure slot.
So I guess one of us will be staying awake on this flight.
Yeah, I guess one of us means me. not a bad view out there.
And we're off to work.
Here we go. Now that it's time for bed, it's time to get in an airplane.
You've been awake a long time.
I know. I could take a nap right now.
Japanese business culture is universally known for being relentlessly efficient, professional, and timely, and this reputation is well-deserved. On the whole, the Japanese take a tremendous amount of pride in their work, and this is especially true of the team at Japan Airlines. Technically, they weren't even our customer. We were working for the buyers of the two aircraft, purchased primarily for the engines, the APU, the landing gear, and a cache of spare parts. JAL handled us on departure from the ramp in front of their maintenance hangar, which was a little ways down from the passenger terminal.
All right.
So can I ask catering to bring it up?
Yeah, that would be great.
Thank you.
The night before, I received a call from the JAL ground operations manager at Haneda, who proceeded to go down a point-by-point itinerary and task list for departure. Times were listed down to the minute and included weather and de-icing contingencies that, if needed, moved certain tasks by 27 minutes. Seriously. The aircraft was a Boeing 767-300, a straight 300 versus a 300ER, so it was used for mainly high-density short-distance operations as opposed to JAL's ER fleet, which had comfier seats and more range. It was still a 767, though, so it had plenty of endurance, and the Pacific Crossing was a non-stop random route flight from Tokyo to Great Falls, Montana. There, we'd clear customs, take on some fuel, and then fly one last leg to Blytheville, Arkansas, the airplane's final resting place.
Hey,
I see you masked up again.
What's that thing in your hand?
It is a camera.
Yeah, I had to put the mask back on. Everybody keeps coming up here talking to me.
So. Oh, yeah? Are they getting pissed off if your mask isn't on?
Seems to care, but yeah, they wouldn't say anything here.
Huh.
If they were pissed off.
There was a guy out there with a whistle marshaling some other truck. It was really bizarre. I videoed it. Well, it looks like kind of... Dude, this thing has got full JAL logo still.
I know. That's a surprise.
Like, completely. Everything. The flag, everything.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, man. Maybe it's like an exception for COVID.
Normally, most identifying logos and marks are painted over for ferry flights, especially planes that are retiring from service and bound for part out.
Oh, geez, I hope so.
At least not here.
Let's see, the moment of truth. What do we have? What do you think, man? Do you think we have anything?
I'd say if Japan's in there.
Let's see. Let's see if Japan is in there. Do we have a winner? We have Japan. We have our current location. Let's see now. Should we try Anchorage? Do we have Anchorage? We have Anchorage. That is a positive sign. Do we have...
No, there's almost no chance in hell that we have Great Falls.
There's no fucking way we have Great Falls.
No.
No Great Falls. But do we have Memphis?
Yeah, there's...
No, we don't have Memphis. Do we have Los Angeles? We have LAX, so it's the JAL route network is what we've got.
It's my glasses off, my mask off, and I've just heard that there's no ovens on this airplane. I think I'm going to have to go make a call to our union representative to get some decent food on this flight or I'm not going.
So, Tokyo, Japan to Great Falls, Montana. You have to wonder if this route has ever even been flown before, right? Maybe a wealthy cattle rancher on a Gulfstream 5? I don't know, but I'd say that it's probably the first time an airliner has flown this particular route. We picked Great Falls because the fuel price was good and they had customs available at our planned ETA, which, thanks to Japanese efficiency, we were right on track for.
Jesus.
Yo, Nomadic 526, we are at spot 214, ready, push back and start.
JAL provided about 15 uniformed ground support personnel consisting of ramp agents, mechanics, and supervisors. As has always been the case, they executed their duties with precision and pride, and then lined up to watch the final pushback of this iconic plane, a staple of the JAL fleet for a generation that would soon be phased out completely.
Taxi via Whiskey Hotel, Oscar Mike Delta 526.
We started taxi right on time for our 3:05 departure slot, then settled in for the 9-hour and 5-minute flight across the Northern Pacific. The airplane was in perfect condition, other than the captain's seat, which was a nightmare.
Dude, the seat is like, I'm like fucking buried in the... This is terrible. There's two big fucking metal things in my ass. There we go. You ready?
Yep. Let's do it.
All right. Making a right turn at 700 feet. We'll go around the Ave.
You got it.
Set thrust.
Thrust up. Speed's alive.
With zero wind, this flight would have actually taken over 11 hours. But thanks to a strong winter tailwind, we'd save two. Tokyo to Blytheville, Arkansas sounds like a ridiculously long day, but by ferry standards, this two-leg 12-hour mission was about as easy as they come.
We're now climbing out, almost a cruise. And I'm gonna go see what the catering situation's like. Here's the galley. That was 7-6. Oh wow, they labeled it. Unbelievable. Looks like we got ramen. We got fruit tray, sandwiches, salad, beef, and rice ball. Now comes the hunter coffee. Let's see how that works. So apparently there's some coffee in there somewhere. We got a ramen soup, we got coffee, we got water. Wow, there's a lot of stuff in there. Sandwiches. Look at this. This is some serious catering. We got really, really good looking beef there. Trying to enable this stuff. So the beef looks amazingly good. And then I think in the bottom here, we've got like the fixings for like the ramen. Like there's egg and meat and things like that. And they're in these warm packs, and then we just mix it with the noodles in there. And the food, man.
Well, it's not as good as last night, but it's still pretty damn good. Very tender.
Yeah. It's pretty hard to go back to anything after last night.
Yeah. Best
man in the world. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure this is why you, I just don't know if it's just not COVID.
A When we ordered our catering a week in advance, I didn't know we'd be having Kobe Wagyu the night before, so we ordered essentially the same thing as our main meal. But no regrets. Even if I did, I'd probably have made the same exact decision.
Tokyo Nomadic 526 position. Nomadic 526, we check 35 North 150 East 0706, flight level 370. Estimate 35 North 160 East 0753. 36 North 170 East next. Over.
Nomadic 526, we're going out there.
As we pressed on eastbound, 8 miles above the treacherous, frigid January waters of the North Pacific, enjoying our high-end catering and wearing bedroom slippers, alone in a 300,000-pound widebody, we talked about all kinds of nonsense while the sun slipped away behind us. It would reemerge a few hours later as we approached landfall over North America. Passing time on a long nighttime leg across the ocean involves keeping the mind and body active. Since I started filming trips, messing with the camera equipment and mounts is one way to counteract the boredom. It's also important to move around, and because there's no passengers on board, we keep the cockpit door wide open.
Something you don't see every day.
The E&E compartment is a room below the floorboards of the front galley, and it houses all of the radios, computers, and electrical control boxes for the vast majority of the aircraft systems. It's not a place we normally access in flight, but it is possible through a panel in the floor. I have gone down there in flight to re-rack a faulty radio in the past, but this time it was just for the sake of video. Of course, I brought a portable oxygen bottle with me just in case of a depressurization event.
We're 37,000 feet.
Eight hours in, we crossed over the western edge of British Columbia and across the Canadian Rockies, west of Calgary, and into central Montana, where the ground was covered in a fresh layer of snow and the outside air temperature well below freezing. Sometimes visually picking up these small airports that we operate into from the air is difficult, and the snow-covered ground didn't help. During my airline days, I operated into Great Falls with the MD-80 pretty often, so I had a vague idea of what I was looking for, but Bob didn't, and the two of us scanned the ground for any signs of an airport. Of course, we had the ability to shoot an instrument approach, worst case scenario, but we wanted to give the visual approach a try for the sake of saving time.
Plus five. I don't fucking see it. It's all the same. Oh, it's the fucking same. I got it.
0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0 9 0
What's 30 landing check?
Down 3 green.
Down 3 green.
Thank you.
just a technical stop to add a little bit of fuel and clear customs inbound. The goal of any tech stop is to be in and out in an hour or less, and since we were basically the only active operation on the field, that wasn't going to be a problem. U.S. Customs met us at the airplane and inspected the cabin and cargo compartments and verified our general declaration. Then he drove us over to their office to run our passports and get us processed in. Though small airports can be challenging in other ways, they're much simpler and often far cheaper than landing at major international airports and dealing with the airline handling agents who are dealing with dozens of other flights at the same time.
How you feeling, Bob?
Trying to thaw out. Barely talking sober.
Arizona boy here.
Exactly. My blood's so thin.
As has been par for the course throughout this trip, we were back at it, taxiing out an hour later and on time. All that remained with this one was a 2-hour and 45-minute hop across the country to Blytheville, Arkansas, a small airport in a small town about 2 hours by car north of Memphis, Tennessee. There wasn't any en route weather to speak of, but the local weather on arrival in Blytheville was supposed to be bad. Low ceilings, rain, fog, it was all in the forecast, and with no ILS approach, I wasn't much looking forward to it.
This thing's gonna climb like a motherfucker.
When an airplane is going to part out, we obviously want to land with as little fuel as possible, as it will either go to waste or become fuel for the diesel tugs and tractors at the airport. But because the weather in Blytheville was bad, we needed some more reserve fuel for the possibility of holding and a diversion to Memphis. Still, we had under 29,000 pounds of fuel on board, so the plane was super light and climbed like a homesick angel. Hungry once again, I ran to the back to grab one last snack. Bob was good with his M&M supply and didn't partake.
Enjoy during flight. Matcha ring. They like matcha on everything, man. This is interesting. It's like a cinnamon ring.
So, Blytheville technically does have an ILS approach, a ground station-based precision instrument approach that gives us vertical and lateral guidance down to 200 feet above the runway threshold. But if you remember, I mentioned previously that it wasn't available. Both the glide slope, the radio frequency that gives us vertical guidance, and the approach lighting system were both out of service, so our only option was a localizer-only approach that only gives us lateral guidance to the runway. The vertical path would need to be maneuvered manually, and because of this, the minimums would be higher. This means that we'd have no bright approach lights to guide us in, and we'd need to be in a stabilized position to maneuver to land visually upon reaching 300 feet above the ground. And with the cloud layer reported at 400 feet, it was going to be tight.
All right, vertical speed, going to go down 800. Ground contact.
A non-precision approach into a non-towered airport in a Boeing widebody with the weather at minimums is something we often plan for, but rarely actually get to execute. It happens a few times per year, but this is where practicing these kind of approaches in the simulator really pays off.
Lights. Okay, I've got approach lights about 12:30.
Continuing.
Well, if you get the runway.
Got it. Autopilot's off.
Another one. So you get the 800,
900. Yeah,
whatever. 11,000 feet of runway, so you got a lot of runway.
Yeah.
150 feet.
100 to 1 feet, 6 and 9, 50, 6 and 6, 30.
That was tight.
That was tight. That was as tight as it gets.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking we're gonna make it. I was like,
I didn't think so either. I was getting ready.
I was too. I was getting ready to start punching any more hits for that. I think we just get to all over.
All right, we're here.
We made it.
With this one behind us, the second and final JAL 767 would move 2 weeks later.
Look at all those MD-80s.
Yeah.
A lot of old junk.
Bird was an identical sister ship other than the One World livery that, just like the last ship, was fully intact.
They said bye-bye, Bob.
We're out of here.
Let's get out of here.
The weather was also pretty much the opposite of the last one, with rainy IFR conditions in Japan, strong winds and no snow in Great Falls, and clear skies in Blytheville. I usually post a short video on Twitter, now X, before each flight, which I call the one-minute tour. I either start inside and work my way to the exterior, or vice versa, pointing out key details about each aircraft or notable things about the trip. I normally hit the post button right before I put my phone down prior to push, but I sent it a little early on this one and ended up scrolling the replies while Bob took down the clearance in Tokyo. One of the replies got my attention.
All right, so I'm not one for believing like this kind of stuff, but somebody on Twitter said that this airplane is haunted. I don't know why they said that, but somebody said in Japanese, and I learned through Google Translate that, I don't know, someone spotted figures walking around on this airplane before on a trip from Europe empty. I don't know, but in the spirit of trying to see something and scare myself to death, and I dimmed all the cabin lights, and we're gonna take a walk and see if we see anything, because why not.
Not gonna lie, there are times when I'm roaming around the dark cabin at altitude that it can get a bit spooky. Whether it's the vast, dimly lit, empty space, the creaks and clanks from the loose items bouncing around with turbulence, or the thought of the millions of souls that once sat in all these seats over the years, I don't know, but it's freaky to begin with. I was convinced that if I was ever gonna see something, this was gonna be the time.
Thank you.
I went to the back alley, Bob. I didn't see any ghosts. No. I know. But maybe when I review the tape later, maybe I'll see some. It's, man, it's dark out there. We're, 38,000 feet. And we're out over the middle of the Pacific. An empty 767.
Well, so much for that. I didn't see anything out of the ordinary, despite trying to will it into existence. Once I got on the ground, I searched the internet for any stories, rumors, or hints about this specific airplane being haunted, and came up empty-handed.
Here, this will give you the final.
One of the things I love about ferry flying is the variety. Variety of planes, variety of cities and countries, even drastically different climates in the course of a single day. While all this change keeps you on your toes, the downside is that you never really get to settle into a routine, and surprises often lurk around every corner. Airline pilots thrive with predictability and routine, and as you build experience doing mostly the same thing day after day, you gain a level of familiarity with all the airports in your airline's network. You know each approach and the location of each taxiway, and most of all, you know who to call when you inevitably run into problems. As a ferry pilot, though, you're almost always operating in uncharted territory. The only exception to this is when we have a multi-ship project like this one. By the time we get to the second airplane, the trip instantly becomes easier. Knowing what to expect along the way brings confidence and better efficiency.
I have light full traffic, Nomadic 527 is a heavy boat, 767. We are now still about 15 miles west of the airport. We are going to plan about a 10 mile final.
Unlike the previous trip, Blytheville was under clear blue skies with this one, and all the small single-engine planes were buzzing around, so we coordinated our position with them over CTAF.
Left one. He checks left side. All right, you're number one, man.
Traffic's at that other airport.
It's at the other airport.
Traffic, 3871, turn it down, man. For runway 19er,
Blytheville area traffic, Nomadic 527 and 767 is on a 2 mile final runway 28, Blytheville International.
2022 is a busy year for us at Nomadic, mostly dealing with the reactivation and return to service of aircraft parked during the pandemic, but also for 767 cargo conversions. Though these two planes were not destined to become freighters, I'd have to assume that the engines, APU, gear, and many of the parts worked their way into the freighter fleet. I've been to Blytheville a few times since delivering those 767s and can confirm that they're still there, at least what's left of them.
It is so windy out there, it is ridiculous.
You can hear the whistling. To walk out there.